Hey, Shopomaniacs, welcome to the 2K19 edition of the Shop Talk Show. We're heading into the future.
Oh, heck, I forgot about that. This is literally our first one, isn't it?
Season. First one heading into 2K19, the eighth year of the Shop Talk Show. Welcome aboard the Tron train, as I like to call it. Woo woo!
Well, that's wonderful. I'm really looking forward to this season. Dave and I have been deep in the throes of planning and stuff, but we have a great guest to kick off the year with a kind of a fundamental thing that if you're a front end designer developer, you better as heck be good at, and he can help you get there. His name is Eric Kennedy. Hey, Eric.
Hey, how's it going?
Fantastic. Eric is a fellow Oregonian with me. He keeps threatening to come visit me.
I'm in Seattle
these days. Oh, are you? Shoot, I thought.
Yeah.
Seattle, a little bit further drive, but not too bad.
I can smell the flannel from here. this place reeks of flannel.
You know, I think I first, I guess, became aware of Eric, or it was probably writing. You know, Eric is, you know, has a medium and stuff and writes about design topics and stuff very eloquently, and notably has this big course, LearnUI.design, has one of those coveted .design domains, which I think randomly, it just occurs to me, is a sponsor of this episode. But that's...
Ka-ching sound that's effect.
How that appropriate.
Weird.
Not even planned.
Weird synergy. Absolutely not planned. The URL, learnui.design, is a course that Eric runs. Do you want to just introduce yourself and tell us about your writing and your place in the world and your course and whatever else you want to say?
Sure, yeah. So my name is Eric. I studied software engineering in college and like programmed for the first time in college. Immediately thought, this is what I'm going to do with my life. This is incredible.
Nice.
Did a couple internships as a developer and realized that like, everything I liked about creating my own little side projects and stuff like that was not how most programming went when you did it as a profession for a larger company. So I was like, what am I going to do now? And I kind of stumbled my way onto design. And I had done some UX stuff in college, and then I was at Microsoft for a couple of years, did some UX stuff there. And so I thought, okay, you know, I'll do freelance UX design. I'm going to get this big breadth of experience. I'm going to do as many projects as possible in a quick amount of time and just kind of see where I want to land after that. And that didn't really end up happening. I didn't really land in one place so much as I realized that as a UX designer, you know, I'd go and I'd make these wireframes and do these user tests and user research for my clients. But I hand over these wireframes and they'd say, hey, this looks really nice, but can you make it look like an app? Like it's a bunch of boxes and arrows. It's not like this is... It's nice for us, but it's not what we ultimately need. And someone needs to make this thing look like an app. And so I took
Were they actually wireframes, or were they criticizing your actual finished design kind of looked like a wireframe?
No, they were wireframes. I mean, it was like with balsamic or whatever.
Yeah. Okay.
So I don't blame them, right? Because it's like if you're hiring a designer and then you kind of think, oh, I'm going to get something that's designed or whatever, but maybe you're not totally familiar that UX is going to like stop at this wireframe level, or you are familiar with that, but then you're like, well, shoot, I didn't really plan for who's going to make this look nice. Now I have to go hire someone else. Like, so I just said, like, and I think every freelancer should do this. Like, yeah, sure, I can do that. I'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. And that sort of launched a large journey of a lot of failure, a lot of just trying to like fiddle around and scramble through Dribbble and try and understand like what makes things look nice. Because the first attempts that I took at design, like I saved some of those and they're just a mess. They're like just disgusting.
So you kind of came to this later in life. I mean, you had big, kind of dream jobs for people, not as a like aesthetic designer, and then came to that later. Yeah.
If you had told my software engineer interested self that I was going to ultimately be making things look pretty for a living, and it's not just that, right? The UX is still a component, and I do code for my clients as well. But like, if this aesthetic UI visual design was going to be such a big part of it, I'd be like, what? I can't do that.
Okay, so that's fascinating. So you taught yourself it, and thus it was kind of perhaps fresh in your mind, or like that journey was so much more clear to you because you experienced it as like an adult rather than like, I don't know, I my early college days were, you know, making arrows in Illustrator. So I can't remember that journey as well. I just happened to be a designer.
Yeah,
now.
I feel like anything that you have to struggle with a little bit yourself before you figure out what the answer is, like you're going to like really remember that lesson. So it was just all super impressed upon me that most of the stuff that I could find online, it was a huge pain point because most design advice online, most design blog posts, it's kind of like this SEO bait, but it's not really useful. It doesn't, for me, the kind of the critical thing with design writing online is if I have a crappy looking design and I read your article, will it make my design look better? And the answer was almost universally no. So I was like, okay, I have to figure this stuff out.
A lot of, like, especially back in the day, I felt like a lot of the design is like, of course, we all know who Dieter Roms is, and therefore make your website that. And you're like, I don't know who that is.
Oh, so. Yeah, right? And I mean, and fair enough, there are great designers in the past, but like, it just felt like kind of this received art school dogma, like here are the people you must worship and the designs you must like think are good. And like some of them looked good, but it's not applicable. Like when you have a responsive website, like the Swiss style poster is not much help. And like a 12 column grid is like of limited use when you're designing, you know, a mobile app. It's like each column is going to be what, 20 pixels wide? Do I really use these things?
So a lot of that advice, not only dated, like, pre-responsive kind of or mobile, but yeah, a lot of it is not so helpful. That's an interesting point. A lot of the web design advice is very desktop-y and not very mobile centric, or if it's like mobile design advice, it's just for apps, you know.
So. I can't tell you how many articles I've read about how to pair typefaces, and I just have no idea. I don't even know what to tell you right now after reading those, you know. I was just, not that I'm some talented designer that you should listen to necessarily, but
should we talk about it?
Like, I don't know. I'm just going to try some stuff. Do you want to go there? I mean, I want to ask you about all those different things. But yeah, since that was a kind of natural transition, tell me how you would do it.
Yeah. So I think like I also have read a bazillion articles about that. And they all seem to be giving, well, there's a couple different schools of advice that you see and they sort of conflict. And I think there's a way to reconcile them. Like, I think a lot of articles will tell you about kind of comparing the skeletons of the typefaces. And I'm sure you've seen this, right? Where they'll like overlay the fonts and they'll talk
about
how
that's the kind of thing that sounds great. And then you're like, but in practicality, I'm just probably going to like go through my font menu and pick some stuff and see how it looks.
Yeah. Right. So I think that can be useful as like a double check, but it's like that's just one possible justification for why two fonts might pair nicely. I think the first decision you need to make if you're considering using two fonts for whatever your project is, the first decision you need to make is like, am I more on the side of the spectrum that's just something that's kind of clean and simple, or am I more on the side of the spectrum of something that has a really involved brand? Most clients, in my experience, by far, and most projects that I've worked on, are like fairly clean and simple. Like there might be some sort of brand, there might be something that kind of makes them unique, like whatever, they use some neon colors, or it's a dark UI, or it's a, you know, something. It's not necessarily all boring and looks the same, but like for the most part, they're not looking for some like almost skeuomorphic aesthetic or,
The nature of the typeface itself, they don't want something with like some lobster font. Like
Exactly. It's like Toys R Us. Yeah, you're going to have something that has a really strong kid brand, right? Toys R Us, yeah. They don't even exist anymore. But
sad.
Yeah. But no. Or if you're making, I don't know, some Halloween festival website or something, it's probably going to have some like spooky brand and a bunch of crazy fonts and whatever. But most sites aren't like that. You know, at least for what clients need. And so when you're picking sites for clean and simple, like you have a little more leeway. You can say, oh, I'm going to compare how these skeletons look. That's not as bad. If you are making a site that has a much, like I call it a higher brand, but just like there's more oomph in the brand, it has more of a voice, then that skeleton stuff goes out the window because you're basically just going to pick a font because, this one looks really good. It like, whatever, it has that Halloween brand or it has that kids feel to it or something. And you can pair it with almost whatever works. And either way, I think it's like for the body font, whatever you're using as your body font, you have way more restrictions on that. Like legibility wise, it's going to be smaller. People are going to spend more time reading it. So that one you should almost certainly pick first and pick one that like for a low brand site, it's like you could almost go with any, you know, at least now some clean, simple sans serif. Or there's plenty of good serifs out there. And then pick something that maybe contrasts a little bit for your header, especially with these low brand sites, like something with I like to call it like something that has interesting letter forms. When you have type that's displayed at bigger sizes, it's kind of this, if you look at a lot of really good designs, you're going to see that they almost use that type displayed at a big size as a way to show off the interestingness of the characters. And that's something you'd miss if it was smaller. Here's an example, CSSTricks.com. Mm. Yeah. So you guys are using Rubik for the header. Oh, by the way, your design looks awesome. If people haven't seen this, they should go look. The redesign, it's really cool.
Yeah, Rubik is a little Toys R Us-y almost, which I don't mind.
Yeah, it is, but like I feel like it works for you guys because you've always been like it's been a great resource, but it's like there's a humanness to it, there's a little bit of warmth to it. So I feel like it's great.
And yeah certainly. Rubik, I would never okay a really stark, you know, mad looking font. I mean, I hope always that our, you know, what little brand we have is kind of soft and friendly and...
Yeah, exactly, right? And this is, well, yeah, and you want to kind of place this on the brand scale. It's like, for the most part, this is clean and simple, but it's definitely like, you're like kind of trying to push for something that's really interesting, a little out there, not the typical stuff that you see in a lot of sites. And I think you guys did that really well. But yeah, Rubik is a perfect choice here. It works really well. It says, hey, like, you can see, I mean... When you, what size are these titles? 50 or 60 or whatever. You can see just how soft the edges of all the letters are. And that's nice. And then what'd you pick for the body font? Oh, it's just the system font. It's just got to load fast.
It is, which I, yeah, right. Because I just am so, I find that so appealing that it's just instantly there. And there's just no loading story that you have to think about whatsoever there. That's kind of the thing there. But I honestly did pick it because a lot of the comps were also Rubik. Because Rubik's, you know, is medium or light or, you know, regular or whatever it is. Looks good too. Like it, yeah. I think it works both as a header and type and body copy okay.
Yeah.
But I was like, you know, like it's when I overlaid them on top of each other, I'm like, it's really not that different than at least from San Francisco. The difference might be different, you know, on Windows where that's not, you know, the default or on Linux or on other choices.
Looks good on Windows, my dude.
Does it? Good.
Yeah.
That I found that Rubik at body copy sizes wasn't that different than just a generic kind of clean sans serif looking thing. So I was like, you know what? Screw it.
Yeah. Totally. So like, you know, you may not have thought, oh, we went through all this whatever fancy design comparison of stems and bowls and letter forms. And no, you don't always have to. Like if you have kind of a simple rationale for why something works and you go, I think this is right. It's like, you just need to know what those rationales are and where to place your site in the bigger scheme of things or your project in the bigger scheme of things.
Okay. That's good. And so we glossed over that. So hopefully that this isn't contributing to, picking typography fatigue that we mentioned in a way, but I think there are some good advice there, and certainly I'm sure there's you go deep into that in your courses and things.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so let's keep on this thread. I think this is nice because picking fonts is just one aesthetic choice that you might make for your thing, and certainly something that you know had to level up on during your own journey. But there's so many others as well. There's color, and there's layout, and there's other things like how things lay on top of other things and how things respond to other things and stuff. What's one of your favorite ones to talk about? Is color one of them?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'll talk about whatever, right? Like it's all interesting to me. Yeah. Color is fascinating too. That was something where at least when I was kind of clicking around trying to figure out how to make color look good. And by the way, I mean, I remember from my first designs, like I was making all of these mistakes that I couldn't even identify as mistakes. Like the net result, I'd be like, wow, this just sucks. But
I'd love to dig into that, but let's wait on it just for a minute. The early mistakes kind of stuff, because you probably see it now with your students as well. But like, you know, what's the process for picking colors that go together? And then even if you do that, because I feel like sometimes we're just handed colors that are supposedly great to go together. I just the other day, I was putting together a post of some kind of color-like resources, and gosh, there must be dozens of sites that are like, here's an amazing palette here you go. It's five colors. Enjoy. Now your color, your color problems are solved in a way. And I've always been so like, I'm attracted to those sites because I do want to be given colors. You know, like everybody wants to be told what to do. And then you look at them on that site and you're like, those are five wonderful colors. I agree, color palette site. Those look hot together. But
I almost feel like
what I need.
I almost feel like those five rectangles next to each other is a totally separate art form, right? Like what looks good as five swatches is completely removed from what looks good as a website. Because like, what are you going to do? Like pick the first one, put it as your button. Take the second one, put it as your sidebar. Take the third one, put it as your header. It's like, it's just going to be a mess, right?
I found it hilarious. There's a kind of a competing course perhaps, but the refactoring UI, and I've mentioned this a couple of times on the show, have a hilarious article about this where they take those five swatches and just randomly apply them to a Slack-like interface, and it just looks like a cartoon.
It's like ridiculous. Completely nuts. Yeah. So you can get a couple good ideas from a palette. You could say, oh, I really like, whatever, one or two of these colors. But for the most part, like, what's the most common color you're going to use in your interface? It's always gray. And by gray, I mean inclusive of white and black, right? So something that has a very low saturation, and we can go into the saturation too, but like something that just really doesn't have a lot of color in it, could be light, could be dark, but like that's going to be by far the most common stuff. And then you're really like, it's really easy to add too much color too quickly, especially for beginning designers. So I like highly recommend that you just start adding color a little bit at a time. And by and large, it's not like you have this received palette, which you just kind of dab. I mean, it really is like the painting metaphor. You dab from your palette and you paint it onto your UI. It's like, no, it doesn't work that way. First of all, like one green that works for a button might look totally garish if it's like your whole header or your whole sidebar or something that's like much larger in terms of the number of pixels.
That's fascinating, right? Like it might look great as a little accent color, but the second it gets too much, you know, it just starts being like, ah, and it doesn't, yeah. Those, you got to be aware of that. The color itself had nothing to do with that, or I guess it does, but it's the usage of the color is so much more important than the color itself, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's completely true. You'll see it again and again. So that means, in my opinion, the main skill of using color in UI design is learning how to adjust the colors that you start with. So for me, this often looked like waltzing into a client project and they have a logo. Somehow they always have logos whenever you show up. And it's like, okay, there's some green in this logo. Like, I guess we're going with green, or like, you know, maybe something slightly different. But usually the logo and the brand and what everyone's thinking kind of suggests a way to go. From then on out, you're basically taking that one color and you're modifying it to suit your needs. And so like where there's many more pixels covered with that color, you're going to have like, oftentimes you're going to have a little more desaturated, maybe a little bit lighter. Like it's just not going to catch your eye as much. You need like a lighter variation, something that doesn't pop out as much. And then for those small accents, it's like, yeah, you do need, you can go full strength. You can even up it from whatever color is in the logo or whatever. But adjusting color is like a huge skill. And I actually have a big article about that too. It's called Color in UI Design, a Practical Framework. If you just search that, I'm sure it'll be the top thing. So you can learn all about that and the HSB system and so on.
Speaking of HSB or whatever kind of, I don't know, color formula you're thinking in, is it like, so I have my gray and my black, my white, and some grays potentially. Maybe I'm even doing a good job with them, and I have a couple of other colors as well that I've been handed by a logo or a beautiful mm-hmm. color palette generating site. That so I have this like teal or something that I'm going to use. That you're not locked into that. Would that be a mistake too? Be like, well, this is my accent color, so I'm going to use it. That you'd be like, no. Now you have like a, I don't know, you have a hue, but you can still saturate and unsaturate and lighten, de-lighten it, and it doesn't necessarily take away from kind of the branding of that teal.
Exactly. When you view the color that the logo is giving you, not as like a fully defined hex, like single color in the whatever millions there are, but you view it as kind of like this base hue from which you can modify. It's like, yeah, it becomes way more free. That allows you to make those adjustments and use it in all the parts of the UI that you need to. That's really what it is. It's like starting with the hue.
That's a great, wonderful way to think of that. It makes me think of the language of CSS as well, too, because I've been just recently looking at like what a lot of people are asking for out of the language CSS. And I found it somewhat common that people are asking for kind of native color adjustment functions, which maybe you would argue does exist if you are working in HSL anyway, but maybe not the other possible ones. And certainly there's no preprocessor like lighten, darken, saturate, desaturate kind of functions in the native CSS. Would you lean on those when you're coding, or do you kind of prefer, you know, maybe tweaking those colors in some other fashion and then variabilizing them perhaps?
Yeah, I don't know. So I don't want to speak too much to the coding part. Like, you know, if I'm making some prototype for my clients, it's basically just me who's going to be developing it and maybe one or two developers who's going to be looking at it and kind of templating it out into the like full system. And so I can kind of do whatever I want. It doesn't have to work across like hundreds of people. And so I totally suspect that like if it's a small project, it's like fine. Yeah, just do whatever adjustment in code you want to do. But if it's a larger one, then maybe you'd have to get a little more standardized ahead of time. I think it just varies on the project.
That's cool. So that I love that way of thinking about color, you know, that like, you know, it's a lot of grays and there's some, you know, just maybe a handful of other colors that, you know, don't, and sprinkle it in lightly, especially if you're a beginner.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is sponsored by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean offers the simplest, most developer-friendly cloud platform. It's optimized to make managing and scaling apps easy with an intuitive API, multiple storage options, integrated firewalls, load balancers, and more. From predictable pricing to flexible configurations to world-class customer support, you'll get access to all the infrastructure services you need to grow. Plus, DigitalOcean's community provides over 2,000 cloud-agnostic tutorials to help you stay up to date on the latest open-source software, languages, and frameworks. And just as a personal anecdote, I just finished setting up a Discourse server, which is kind of like an old school forum software, on a digital cloud instance. And it was super easy to get configured, set up, and I really don't know what I'm doing with that kind of stuff. And DigitalOcean made it super easy. You can get started on DigitalOcean for free with a free $100 credit at do.co/shoptalk. That's do.co/shoptalk for a free $100 credit to get started with DigitalOcean.
Maybe we'll take a detour and talk about that beginner thing a little bit, because I'm so curious about that from the kind of the student and the early perspective of learning design. In what, like, what do you find as like the biggest problem? What was the biggest problem for you, and what was the biggest problem for students that you teach now, like in the early days of their journey? Like, why are their designs so bad?
I mean, I could name like 20 or 30 things that are like common mistakes. But I feel like so many of them boil down into problems of consistency and problems of alignment. And for me, one of the like most non-trivial things to realize about what I thought is good design and still do is that almost everything on the entire page is aligned with something else. Like 99% of the elements are either centered, because centering is an aligning of centers, mm-hmm. right? Or they're like aligned by one of their edges. And you can look at, you can pop open Dribbble or Behance or whatever, and you're just going to see this again and again and again and again. So much alignment. So that was like one big thing that I didn't understand going in, and that, and like learning, yeah, that,
I mean,
really
you
helped.
You can see that when you look at an amateur design, right? That there's it's lacking alignment all over the place, and the strength of that design can come up so quickly by just grabbing a hold of those elements and yanking them over to align with other things.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other one that's like a little more difficult to just kind of give examples of in words is problems of consistency. It's like where I have whatever, four different button styles on my page, and one of them is, you know, like three of them are different sizes and ones that I did in CSS, and then one of them is the native button element. And like, it's like, why would anyone do it this way? It's not to say that every button on your page should look the same. It obviously should not. But like, consistency, like I feel like most beginning designers underutilize consistency. They don't realize that if you have, say, just some form, let's say you have a table and you have some form controls on top of it that filter it, sort it, add a new item or whatever. By default, unless you can think of a really good reason to otherwise do this, all of those elements should have the same border radius, the same height. Like they should have a consistent scheme for width. They don't necessarily have to have the same width because their content's dynamic. If there's like buttons, they should have the exact same color, background, gradient, or what, you know, whatever that is. Like they should just be consistent in every way that makes sense, and they should really only vary in ways where you can come up with a reason for why they should vary.
That's great. That's great. And if you think you have problems with consistency at the design level, just wait until somebody else implements your design. Then they're really going to get inconsistent with it. You got to bring the consistency from day one.
Design systems, take a shot.
You know, we talked about like limiting or like picking a gray, but or like, you know, choosing, you know, making sure trying to justify the reason you have 32 different buttons or whatever. But what are kind of ways you sort of, you know, how many grays are too many or how many button styles are too many? Where do your spidey senses kind of go off on, oh no, I've maybe, or maybe you or maybe some design you're looking at that they've kind of gone down a pitfall. Like, do you have any like triggers, I guess, to where you kind of like start like, okay, this is kind of starting to fall apart.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because the two questions you asked, how many grays is too many and how many buttons are too many? I feel like those are the opposite side of the spectrum. Like for how many grays is too many, I'm going a little bit against the grain here because I realize there's so many people are in favor of palettes and like, you know, kind of that material design, like gray 100, gray 200, gray 300, all, you know, a little bit lighter or darker than the next and kind of lining those up and they're just dabbing them on. And even if you have 10 grays, like you should always be able to like come up with something with 10 grays. I think there's cases where like 10 is just not enough and you need something slightly different for this specific case and just use it because like the consistency matters in so much as the user can tell that things are consistent, and it doesn't matter in so far as they can't. And this is actually, I think, why the color adjusting bit works, and you can have many, many different variations on your same base color, but like they're in different elements, and they might be divided by hundreds of pixels. And so when that's the case, like a user can't see all those little inconsistencies. They just see like the overall effect is neat and kind of considered. And the same thing with the gray. I think it's like if you break your palette and you come up with an 11th gray, even though your system only gives you 10 or whatever, because you really thought, no, I can justify why I need something in between gray 4 and gray 5 or whatever. It's like, if you do that, that's fine. No user is going to be like, I'm getting a weird feeling about this. It's like, they're not going to know. But if you have a bunch of button styles, they're going to know. And if all the buttons are different heights and some and or they're all different colors or whatever, and that's not part of your brand, they're going to know. It's just going to feel a little off, especially if they're close to each other and they're performing similar functions. It's like that stuff just kind of sticks out like a sore thumb.
I'm going to do something a little trite perhaps, because this is one of the most popular quotes in the world. Possibly, I think it resonates with a lot of people. If you haven't heard it, enjoy this. Or if you have heard it, perhaps you'll enjoy hearing it again. I apologize. This is from Ira Glass, and it has to do with creative work and taste. So let me read a little bit of it. Nobody tells this to people who are beginners. I wish someone told me. All of us who do creative work, we get into it because we have good taste, but there's this gap. For the first couple of years, you make stuff, but it's just not that good. It's trying to be good. It has potential, but it's not. But your taste, that's the thing that got you into the game, is still killer. And your taste is why your work disappoints you. A lot of people never get past this phase. They quit. Most of the people I know doing interesting creative work went through years of this. We know our work doesn't have this special thing we want it to have. We all go through this. And if you're just starting out in this phase, know that it's normal. He goes on a little bit, but does that resonate with you too? I kind of think of you and I think of that like you had good taste and that's what drove you through this. Do you think that's true, that everybody that gets into creative work has this gap between their what they want to build and what they are building?
Oh, I don't think it's everyone. I would say it's a very common thing that I hear from my students where they say, I can recognize good design. I have this gut instinct for what looks good. I cannot recreate it. And that's exactly how I felt. But there's others who are like, I think this is actually way less common, but some people do come into the course or come asking me questions and they say, it's really tough for me even to like try and articulate at the most basic level why something is good or not. They might take something that everyone else thinks is like great design, oh, medium.com or whatever, and go, eh, like I don't really see it. And it's like, okay, let's find something you do see and start there. That's kind of where I'd go with someone like that who wants to get better.
So that's a potential break in this system. I also think the worst position you can be in, this is just me speaking, is when you come into it a little cocky perhaps, or that you already think your own work is kind of good. I'm worried about you immediately, you know? You know, not that, I don't know if there's any way to train you out of that, but certainly there's room to improve there. Like, be worried if you think you've already arrived in design.
Well, and one thing I want to say, which I like your journey just from developer to designer, because if you're a developer, you kind of do design by default. Whatever the machine spits out is designed to some degree. And if you touch CSS, you do even more design. But let's say I have a blog or something like that, and it's great, or I don't know, e-commerce page. But my product layout is I just don't like it. It doesn't, it bothers me every time I look at it, but I don't know how to fix it. I'm in that jam that we kind of were talking about. What are the strategies you do to get out of that? Like, this is ugly, but I don't know how to fix it.
Oh yeah. That's a good question. So you're talking about like the product details page.
Yeah. Just your standard like t-shirt. With some sizes and some info, like, this is a great t-shirt.
I feel seen, Dave.
I'm just saying, like, how do you, like, I was just on a really nice e-commerce site last night, and I just was like, this is so nice. I love it. But how do you break out? You know what I mean? How do you break out of a design piece you don't like?
Right. No, good question. I think the answer is start by finding something that performs a similar job, like some other e-commerce site that you do like, and don't just find one, right? Find many. And for me, I would start, like, maybe it's just kind of that developer mindset, but I would be like so analytical about this. I'd say like, okay, I tried to make this this product details page. It's not coming out so great. Like, what are the ones that I like doing differently? And can I find patterns among those ones in what they're doing differently? And can I, even if the pattern is not something that you typically would think of as being feel free to, if you're doing this, just like make up your own words for something, like find three that you do like and be like, what unifies these? With this product details page, you know what it is? Maybe it's that the product feels like really presented, like they kind of in their own way, each of these three that I like really like put space around it, and they have this really high quality imagery, whereas my photo is like middling, and I think it's that. I think I just need to make this product look like something more worthwhile, more valuable, right? And so that may not be something that's like design school 101, make sure your product and your e-commerce page looks valuable. It's like, no one says that. But if you can identify that that's where the problem lies, or whatever that problem is, and you can do it by looking at ones that you do like, then you can make progress. Then you can say, okay, what do I need here? Better photography, more white space, more alignment, whatever. Yeah, that's what I would do. And that's what I encourage my students to do.
I wish, because I definitely like even preside over a couple of product pages that I don't feel particularly strong about. And sometimes I get in my own way, you know, like I feel like I could do a good job on this page if I could just burn it to the ground and make from scratch choices about the design of this page. Like certainly if I am just designing this product page as a one-off, I can kill this thing. I'll make great markup and CSS for it. I'll start with a beautiful, lovely design. And I get in my own way because I'm like, I don't want to do that. Like, I want it to look great, but I want it to work with the rest of the site. I want it to, like, I'm given this template through some e-commerce software, and I don't know that I want to, like, totally rejigger their whole template because that's, like, technical debt that it's going to bury me under. And, you know, it's just, I don't know, sometimes that's tough. The from-scratch design sometimes feels a heck of a lot easier.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it does. And it's a tough problem too. It's one of those things that made me think there's actually a little bit less value in someone kind of picking a color palette, picking a type scale, picking a full design system before they've even designed a single screen. It's like, there's a little bit less value to that than the internet might lead you to believe, because it's like, you have to see it in action. And then you can say, these font sizes aren't working, or even these typefaces. Like, I just picked the wrong fonts. I need something different. And that's tough. So for other beginning designers or people who are working and they kind of have those constraints where, like, say it's a client and they've already picked out the typeface and the colors and you just have to go with it. It has been remarkable to me how much using a really good typeface is like cheating, just where anything you type looks so much better. And then if you're stuck with some like super overused kind of like spineless font, well, whatever, we can get into my personal preferences later, but like if you have some font where you're just like, it's just kind of meh, it doesn't really have an opinion, or it's just like you're really battling uphill or paddling upstream, whatever.
Interesting. It's nice to pick those like cheat codes to good design. I've always found really incredible photography is kind of a cheat code too.
It absolutely is. That was another thing. It like makes so much difference. I say to every student, it's like, if you have a project where you have the ability to use awesome imagery, use it, because it's like going to just double the strength of your design. And not every project does. It's like, okay, I'm making this CRM app or whatever. Maybe I'm going to come up with, you know, find some really cool illustrations or something.
Right.
But like, if you're like, I think I remember one example with one of my students, he was responsible for doing like a paraglider website. And it's like paragliders, people soaring through the sky over mountain ranges. Like, you better
you better
the
nail
best
that
imagery. Or you, like, you can't even call yourself a designer. It's just begging to have really cool visuals.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by something really cool. It's an alternative to .com. It's the .design domain name. So if you're a designer and you've thought of a sweet name for your website and it isn't available under .com, check out .design. Chances are the domain name you want is waiting for you. You can head to porkbun.com and use the coupon code SHOPTALK on the checkout page to get your free .design domain name for your website. And .design is super widely used too. It's not like it's a super weird one anymore. There's Airbnb.design, Facebook.design, Uber.design, Adobe.design. There's so many of them. It's exactly the same. It's just a domain name, and Google doesn't really care these days. It functions the same way as .com or .org. It's just more interesting. It looks great on resumes or business cards, on email addresses, and it's free. Did I mention that? You can go to porkbun.com and use coupon code SHOPTALK at checkout, and you get a free year of email hosting, Whois privacy, and SSL certs, and all that stuff, which is pretty fantastic. You should go get one right now. Thanks to porkbun.com for sponsoring ShopTalk Show.
Was the type thing, because I'm definitely, like, about 2 years ago, I was so mad at my, like, slide decks for talks and stuff like that. I think I gave a talk in all Calibri, you know, like the default Windows PowerPoint font.
Yeah.
So I finally just was like, I'm picking fonts. And I picked Rubik, and it has like a big mono slabby thing. It's pretty nice. But then, and then like a serif font as well to kind of go with it. It's very different, but it goes with it. So I just finally was just like, I'm going to pick fonts. These are going to be my fonts for the next 5 years or whatever. But how long did it take you to figure out through your kind of self-discovery, like, oh, fonts are the thing. That's actually the one thing I need to pay attention to.
Well, I don't think it is the one thing I need to pay attention to, but like,
well, one of 100.
So I think there were kind of two stages. One is I could see, you know, within like a year of piddling around that the difference that good fonts made was enormous. And so, I mean, many of your listeners will probably be familiar with the 7 rules for gorgeous UI. It was this article I wrote way back in 2014, although I just updated it. And one of these rules was use good fonts. And like, whereas all the other sections in this article, like, contain some design advice or strategy or whatever, this section was just a list of good fonts, because at that point it was like, I wasn't sure that I necessarily could really like go out into the wild and pick a good font from scratch. I could just kind of like go to the few that I knew seemed to work well in my own design experience, or I saw them used again and again in designs that did look really great. And I just thought, okay, like these are ones I know I can trust. And so I think for most designers or people who are getting into design, you start there. You're like, okay, here's some font that I know is really respected. It was professionally made. Like, it looks good as far as I can see. Like, I have this short list and I can pick whatever is most applicable for my project. But then it just goes from there. You do that enough and all of a sudden it's like you can see a font for the first time and go, oh wow, like this is very, like this is definitely a high quality one. No one has to tell you this is a good one. So I suppose it's like anything in that regard. Like you start out just kind of trusting the advice of those who came before and have done this before. And then you gradually just develop your sense of what really looks good. Did that answer your question? I feel like I'm rambling.
Nope. This is all helping me in the Dave Rupert School of Design.
Perfect.
Which is...
I didn't realize I totally stole your aesthetic, Dave. I totally stole your rubric. Oh my gosh.
No way. Terrible. Not at all. Are you kidding me? I'm about to steal your ombre. So deal with that. Get prepared for that. I'm going to rip it off real hard.
Are you talking about the gradient on the site now?
Oh, yeah. On all over CSS tricks. It's beautiful.
It's actually really great. Can I say something about that?
Realize this is Kylie Timpani's work, right? Like I coded it, right, but she's
stealing Kylie's work. Yeah. Sorry, Kylie.
Well, major props to Kylie. So one thing that a lot of designers say to me, or people who have kind of gotten into UI design, they get to the point where they can make something, they can like make most of the elements kind of consistent, they can line up everything pretty nicely. And oftentimes they're doing client work and they're like, the client just says it needs like a little more oomph, like it's just not interesting enough or whatever. Like there's just not enough brand. Or they say, oh, like, I just want that for myself. I want it to be a little bit more remarkable given everything else that's out there right now and that's popular. One of the things that you can do, again, this is kind of like a cheat code, is like, I call it a motif. Figure out if there's some sort of motif that you can use. It could be like a shape, like it could be like if your logo is like has like some dots in a row or something, or like three circles that are all the same size or whatever. Figure out if you can use those circles as a motif and just repeat it in various contexts throughout your site or your app. Like, can you use them as like an underline for headers? Can you use them as a section divider? Can you use them where can you apply this? And so for the new CSS tricks design or redesign, like this kind of this pink to orange gradient is very much your motif. Like if you think about it, I'm scrolling through the site right now. I literally see the flat orange of CSS tricks logo nowhere except for the logo. Everywhere else, it's the gradient that kind of goes through that swath of warm colors. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, you don't have a brand color, you have a brand gradient. And that's like an awesome example of a motif that really makes it stand out. And, you know, even if people can't articulate why, they land on the site and they go, oh, this is cool. This doesn't look like everything else I've seen before.
Her work was so good. It was so fun to build. And I've never had a design launched with this kind of happiness from people, which is awesome. A huge relief for me because hopefully it holds up, you know, because a lot of what you get is just gut instinct stuff. So when you launch something that people don't like, I try to take all that hate with a grain of salt too, because I'm like, you looked at it for 10 seconds, you know, have you lived with it, you know?
Yeah, it's so interesting too, because you've got, I'm sure, like just millions and millions of people visiting this. Like there's going to be a lot of people who don't like it no matter what.
Yeah, and there has been very little of that. A couple of like, you know, I don't know what to, sometimes it's hard to even know what criticism to take seriously. Sometimes I just try to read it super analytically, like what exactly are they saying here? Let me look at it. Can I see that from their perspective or not? And sometimes it breaks down immediately and I'm just like, I feel like they're just being a troll. Like they just want to find something to not like about it.
Sure, yeah.
And I'm just like, well, I'm just going to archive that one because...
Oh, you know what? This is actually a good lead-in to talking about getting design feedback. You want to talk about that a little bit?
I would love to talk about feedback. So in what context? In any context?
Well, so say you're starting out as a designer. You create a couple designs. Maybe it's for a client. Maybe it's for your own project that you're working on with a friend. And either your friend or your client or whoever is like, yeah, I just don't like it. It's like, no. What do you do with that? Sure. This is
motif it.
I find just getting very emotionally hurt and just mad at the person indefinitely is the best way to handle that. Is that kind of where you're going? I'm sorry. I jumped
definitely. In. Cut them out of your life. They're gone.
Yeah. Okay.
What kind of friend are you? First of all, I think all designers just need to have this rule that if you're a self-respecting designer, the words, I don't like it, regarding another designer's design should like never come out of your mouth as feedback to that person, because it's not useful. What I always say is, like, you're not making it to hang on your fridge, right? It's not like, it's not just there to look pretty. Like, it's not art in that sense. Design has to solve a problem.
But you will have that feeling somehow, right? But you need to, like, learn how to squelch it or something.
Exactly. Well, it's just more analyzing. This is why this is, like, the hope for all developers who want to get into design. It's like you can analyze your way through it. Analyze why you don't like it. What is it that would make it better? What's the worst part about it? A lot of this stuff, it will be brand stuff. How does it make me feel that I don't want other users to feel? Or what is the feeling that I want it to excite in other people that it's not currently exciting in me? What I do with clients, and this is something where if you're in a nasty client situation and your client just doesn't like your brand or whatever your designs are, it's kind of tough to back it out and redo things. But with my own clients, I'll say at the beginning, be like, let's figure out the business goals of this product. And those business goals include a brand. And by brand, like tangibly, a brand is just how you want people to feel when they land on your site, when they use your app. And so any feedback needs to, like, ultimately boil down to those business goals. And yeah, maybe we'll discover more as we do this and realize more clearly what we're trying to do. But, like, if you can make the conversation about business goals, which your clients are the experts in, they're the experts in their business and what they want to get out of it. And you're the expert in design and making things look nice and kind of, like, conform to how we expect software to work, then, like, those goals are where you meet in the middle. And keeping the conversation focused on goals feels a lot less personal. And it also keeps you from ever hearing, like, I'm a words of affirmation, love languages kind of guy. Someone goes, I don't like it. It's like, dang it. It really gets to me. But then I don't have to hear that. They say, it doesn't meet this goal. And I'm like, oh, it's not about me. It's about my design. And I can do that.
That stuff always feels like the designer, the design team covering their ass, but in the best possible way. Cause so they never have to hear that. They never have to hear, oh, I don't like your decision here, because you'd be like, whoops, stop. You need to rephrase that in the form of a, does this align with our goals or not? Because ultimately you launch a design that somebody doesn't like, but it sells more hang gliders. Too bad. I don't care what you like. You're the one who told me to sell more hang gliders,
you're
and I'm selling more hang gliders.
On your fridge. You're selling hang gliders. Yeah. And I really don't mean it to be like a self-serving kind of thing. It's not about the designers. That's just a nice side effect. It is, but if you can force a client to be more clear about what it is that they actually want to do, everyone wins. Because that clarity it takes work, and it's not just going to, like, appear out of nowhere with many clients. I guess there's some business savants who will, well, there definitely are.
There's so much of that. Like, even that beginner stuff, like, let's identify all the stakeholders in this project. Well, you're doing that because you want to make sure that you don't get swooped and pooped in week three, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, how do you deal with, like, bad decisions that are kind of mandated on you? Like, oh, we want to throw up a modal here and that just ask them how their day is or something, or fill out a feedback form, like, every time they visit the site. Like, what is your, like, what do you do in those situations? Cause for me, it's like, oh, this is terrible. This is a terrible idea that somebody had. And now it has to be implemented.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that business goals thing kind of makes sense. Like, it's a good framework for trying to bat down some things that you know will obviously harm the user experience and be a net negative, right? Because, like, you know that no one wants to fill out a feedback form every single time they visit the site or even be asked to do that, right? At least if it's in an obnoxious way. Like, that doesn't take that much work to guess. And so you can also bet it's like, well, that's going to hurt some engagement metric eventually somehow. Or we'll see that in some survey or whatever. Like, if you're a beginning freelancer, you might have to put up with a little bit of that stuff, and you may not know the best way to get around it. And that's really unfortunate. I don't know that I have, like, a catch-all answer for that. I've found that, at least for me, not working through an agency, it's like I have a lot of choice in what clients I can take. And I can, and if there's red flags that I see, like, you know, if someone says, well, we don't really have a way for you to talk to users, it's like, oh, that's a huge red flag. Like, if we're doing this, if I'm designing this thing, I want to be able to talk to people about the design who are the stakeholders.
Nothing hurts your net promoter score like asking for a net promoter score.
I would also say this is one of the things I learned at Microsoft. It's like a sneaky political lesson, like the power of later versus no, and saying, well, let's do this simpler design without the, like, feedback modal that pops up all the time. Let's do the simpler design first, and then we can add the modal later.
And later never happens.
Then, well, nice. You said it.
Yeah.
Hey.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I've actually been in situations where tried the later thing and people got very mad because they knew that that was not ever going
to happen. Oh, that's funny. So. Yeah, my wife will like do that to me now. She'll be like, let's do that later. I see what you're doing here.
You're like, hoisted by my own petard. I had another question while we got you. I got a few. I'm burning questions here. Why not just Bootstrap? You know, it's already got it. Already has all the things I need. Bootstrap. Why not?
Yeah. So there's a bunch of reasons. One is so Bootstrap is fine if you're like putting together kind of an MVP. You don't have enough time to delve into the design side of things right now. You don't have enough money to hire a designer. It's like, I can't fault you. It's like an incredible net benefit for the world. But from a purely aesthetic point of view, if you really care about making your app look different, like you're either going to have to go through the work of customizing Bootstrap a whole bunch, which I guess can be done. I've tried to do it and just given up basically every time. Or you're just going to do stuff from scratch anyways. And yeah, I mean, there's a number of choices that if you go with Bootstrap, I'd just like encourage you, make sure you do choose custom fonts. Eventually, that's for most people, that's going to be the right way to go. Try and change some of the icons too. I really, maybe another unpopular opinion, but I don't think Font Awesome is all that awesome. And it looks overused. And it's also all the icons are very soft and bubbly and they kind of scream Bootstrap to anyone who's seen enough on the web. So for most apps that are like supposed to be kind of clean and simple and crisp, I'd look for an icon set that's a little more squared off. We talk more about icons later if we have time, but I just look at customizing all those things, the colors, the fonts, the icons. And I suppose you could get to a point where Bootstrap is just there to like really make your development quicker and kind of have the like provide this pre-baked design system. But it is a lot of work even to get to that point.
It does lead me into one thing I've thought about for years now, don't really know what to do with, but it's about tooling and how tooling affects what we do kind of perhaps without us even knowing about it or thinking about it. And it came up in my mind yesterday because I made a friggin' rectangle in Figma. You ever use Figma? It's great. Nice in-browser design tool thing. I use it for everything now. You can't do a background pattern in Figma. And there's probably like 100 things you can't do in Figma. It's pretty stripped down. I mean, it's got a lot of features, really impressive design tool, but compared to the big design tools of old, it's very feature stripped down. And for example, I was like, I want to put a pattern behind this.
Totally. I mean, everything's feature stripped down compared to Photoshop. And then the problem with Photoshop is it's not feature stripped down.
Right. I mean, that's a problem. But I wonder if, now I'm just like, well, I'll just never do textures because I just, that's not in the design tool that
that's
I use
a
anymore.
Thing. So, Chris, it's like, I wrote an article for CSS Tricks. It was maybe a year or two back. And I was talking about non-rectangular mm-hmm. headers because the design tools dictate certain things that will then become super, super common. I guess CSS does this to a degree too, but if you have a good dev, you can kind of code up whatever, even if it's some crazy thing in Photoshop with layers and animations and whatever. But we're going to be seeing a lot more rectangles, like just because that's really the way Sketch goes. And so this is also, you can flip it on its head instead of saying, wow, all sites are going to look alike and it's going to suck. You can say, if you want your site to stand out, add in an element that you can't do in Figma or Sketch or whatever. Add in something that takes Photoshop to do, whether it's some photo with the background removed and replaced with something else, like some extreme photo editing, or maybe you have some text that seems to like float into the imagery or whatever, or there's some weird transform or it's bubbly or glossy in some way that you can't really Sketch and Figma and the like don't let you think down those lines, but Photoshop does. It's like that's kind of a 201 level thing where it's like, how do I make my design?
Or perhaps even your code does, because I think of things that make the web kind of the web, like things like position sticky elements are very hard to put into a design and think about in a way, but is somewhat easy to do on the web today. It's a little hard to describe, but what position sticky is.
Yeah.
It's just weird. It's kind
of
cool.
It's tough. Like to some degree, I think this is more pronounced when you're designing a mobile app. You almost need to like think with your hands. And if you get too attached to thinking on paper or thinking on Sketch or Figma or whatever, you're going to be missing the full extent of what you're what your app can do. Like when you have a mobile app, it's like there's surfaces, like look how many surfaces are sliding in front of other surfaces, digital surfaces, right? It's all an illusion. But like screens are coming in from like, they're fading into the background. They're like swinging in from sides, or they're sliding in, or they're coming up from the bottom, or their like, cards are expanding. The whole material design philosophy is like built around this, right? Material is this fake material that morphs and transforms into whatever you need it to be. And it's like, there's just this sense of motion inherent to it that you really, it's really easy to lose if you're just staring at a bunch of like static images on Sketch or Figma. And I mean, this struck me as a beginning designer too, is like, I'd be like, man, I don't have enough space to show all this stuff on my mobile app, right? The screen is so small, I can't display it all. How do existing apps solve this problem? Go and look and find out that like, well, they actually do all these fancy tricks where like the name disappears when you scroll down because no one cares, like, and then it's replaced with these stats or whatever, or this disappears and is replaced with this, or this transitions into this. And so it's like just way more dynamic of an experience. And it's, yeah, like the tool kind of makes the end result to a certain degree.
Look at ParavelInc.com for an example of something you can't do in anything, really.
Absolutely. A lot of, like, you guys have a lot of textures and stuff, if I recall.
Yeah, we have textures, and I did like some color cycling animation that was fun. But yeah, you can't, you know, textures is always funny because like we kind of used to use them a lot, you know. But now when you use them, because people aren't used to them, people get mad and are like, I thought my screen was dirty. I was cleaning it for like a half hour.
And you know, it's a trick to make the whole web look like Paravel did it is just you have a filthy screen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You just sneeze on your screen. And congrats, you've achieved the Paravel ethos.
Design hack.
But I you know, the one question, I guess, because we kind of got to wrap up here. But so Shop Talk, we are embarking on a redesign project with Dan Mall and some talented designers. So I guess my question to you, it, like getting free design consultation here, but what, like looking at the Shop Talk show site, and we may or may not take it, you know, but just like what, I guess, is there anything that stands out to you? Like, hey, maybe this would be good, or that would be good, or kind of, is there anything like
that? The ground. So terrible.
Yeah. You can burn it to the ground too. But like what, you know, maybe not, I don't know. This was kind of a, I don't know, Chris, we kind of coded it in a weekend sort of thing, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
to hear your thoughts.
I have a whole backstory too, but I'd rather just hear Eric.
I don't have all that many thoughts just to begin, like right out the gate. I'd want to hear what you think is kind of failing about it, or what people have complained about or nicely said that they didn't like, but where you think it's kind of failing to meet the bar, right? I mean, hate to say it, but it is kind of going back to, what are your goals here? What goals is it not meeting right now? Because from a visual perspective, like, it looks just fine. It's always been perfectly functional. I've come here a bunch of times. Like, it's never let me down. So then you got to dig a little deeper.
Well, we did. I mean, we don't have enough time to go into it, but it's not like we've embarked on this design without thinking about that. I mean, we have a whole giant document that talks about all kinds of ways in which it fails. I mean, you can't really easily look, you know, browse by guest, and there's no search.
Yeah, there's no search.
There's no tags to group shows together. And we have these mini series of shows that go together that there's no way to look at. And, that's just like sortability kind of stuff, but I think it doesn't really like tell you what the show is. It doesn't do a very good job of getting you off the site to somewhere where you could subscribe, which is probably the number one thing that we want people to do when they get here. And that's a fourth of the stuff that we're looking at here. But there's some benefits too, in that those things aren't particularly hard to do, because what's done on this site is a bunch of infrastructural work data wise to kind of do whatever we want with the site. So if, you know, if there's some big idea we have to make it more browsable or connectable in some way, that infrastructural work is kind of done. So that the designer who works on this, which is Dan, and some guest designers we're going to be working with,
the super friends,
will have a lot to do. Not them in this case. This is kind of what we're doing is
his other friends.
Dan is just going to be the art director on it and kind of guide the show. But we're taking like junior designers who, you know, could use a leg up in the world to be the lead designers of this under Dan's guidance. So
very cool.
Kind of interesting. Sorry to make that all about us. Is there anything you'd like to wrap up with this, Eric?
Yeah, all I would say is, like, if the stuff that I've said has been useful, check out learnui.design as the course and learnui.design/blog. So basically a bunch of design writing. It's all meant to be very practical. Hopefully it's useful to your listeners. Oh, and then I also have a mailing list that gets some writing that's never really goes onto the blog and such. And that's at learnui.design/newsletter.html.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on, sharing your kind of journey and wisdom. I think a lot of Shop Talk Show listeners will kind of feel that, identify with, like, I'm pretty okay at development, but need to get better at designing. So really appreciate that. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcast of choice. Thank you for not unsubscribing over the holidays. We really appreciate that. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tons of tweets a month. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.